examples, and this is a work that I've been doing with many people, so some of them are put in here, my collaborators. So let me actually start with the summary of my talk. So one of the things that I will tell you is something that you already know, is that neutrinos are fundamental particles, and that one of the most important discoveries of the last century is the finding that they have masses. So basically, there are two very fundamental questions that we would like to address. And the first one is, what are their masses? And the second one is, what is their hierarchy? So then I will tell you that this is something that we can address using cosmological observables. And I will show you one of the predictions of the Big Bang Theory, that is the existence of a cosmic neutrino background. I will tell you that these neutrinos only represent like a very small fraction of the energy content of the universe, but they have very, very large thermal velocities. And this is the reason why they introduce very particular signatures on cosmological observables. And I will tell you that at linear order, these are things that we understand very well, but that in order to extract the maximum information from cosmological observables, we need to go into the fully nonlinear gene. And then I will tell you that basically many people have done forecasts for how well future experiments, upcoming experiments, are going to be able to constrain the neutrino masses. And basically, the conclusion from all of them, I will say, is that basically we will achieve like a 3 to 4 sigma detection of the neutrino masses, not more than that. And if this is the case, then I will argue that it is very important to have very accurate theoretical prediction in order to avoid any bias in the measurement, and I will give an example of this. And the second thing is that we need to look for new and unique observables in order to try to get at least a 5 sigma detection. This is what we really want. And then I will tell you some of the effects that neutrinos introduce on different cosmological observables that I'm putting here, so halo properties, galaxy clustering, and these things. So let me start from the particle physics side. So as all of you know very well, neutrinos were postulated in the first time by Pauli in 1930 in order to explain the apparent violation of energy, momentum, and spin in the beta decay process. So Pauli was right, and neutrinos were for the first time detected in 1956 in the famous experiment by Cowan and Rhines. So this is how we understand neutrinos, how the standard model of particle physics, the incredibly successful standard model, describes neutrinos. So neutrinos are fundamental particles. They are neutral leptons. There are 3 different families, we know from the C boson. And they have a very, very weak cross-section, and this is why it's so hard to detect them. And very importantly, within the standard model of particle physics, neutrinos are described as massless neutrinos. Basically, because we have never observed right-handed neutrinos. But we know that this is not true. And we know that this is not true because we have observed neutrino oscillation. So this is this phenomena where a neutrino that is produced with a given flavor state, as it propagates through space, it can change its flavor. And just the observation of this phenomena tells us that neutrinos have to be massive. So this has very major implications for physics in general. The first one is that this is telling us, this is the first proof that we have that there has to be physics beyond the standard model, that there is something that we don't understand, I would say. There is physics beyond that. And as you can imagine, this is already by itself incredibly exciting. The second thing is for cosmology. So neutrinos are the second most abundant particles in the whole universe. So if turns out that neutrinos are massive, even though their masses will be small, you will expect, as we will see in detail in this talk, that they will introduce a lot of effort on cosmological observables. And if you want to do precision cosmology, 1% precision cosmology, you need to take into account these effects, but also the other way around. We can use these effects in order to weight neutrinos. And I have put here also for completeness something like to do neutrino astronomy. So the idea is that if you have some astronomical sources that is producing neutrinos and you have a detector that is only sensitive to a given neutrino flavor state, then you need to take into account neutrino masses and neutrino oscillations in order to compute these fluxes properly. So what do we know from neutrino oscillations? So these are really the things that we can measure. So what we really measure is the mass square difference between the different mass eigenstate, and these are basically the numbers that we have measured. But we don't know whether the sign of the third, whether the mass of the third is larger or smaller than the mass of the first. We don't know the sign of this difference. And this gives rise to 2 different orderings, to 2 different hierarchies. So we have the normal hierarchy, where the mass of the third will be larger than the mass of the first. And we have the inverted hierarchy, where we have the opposite situation. So just with these numbers, what we can do is to combine them in order to put a lower bound on the sum of the neutrino masses. So the sum of the neutrino masses has to be at least 60 electron volts in the case of the normal hierarchy, or at least 100 electron volts. So there has been also a lot of efforts on putting upper bounds from cosmology, from laboratory experiments, not cosmology, from particle physics side, upper bounds. And basically, this is the current constraint that we have right now. So the sum of the neutrino masses has to be lower than 7 eV. And as you can imagine, this is not very competitive with cosmology. And we expect that in the near future, with something like Catrin, we can shrink this number to something like 0.6. But still, you will see that this is not competitive with cosmology. So neutrinos are massive. And this has been, as I said before, one of the most important discoveries of the last century. And this has given rise to a set of very fundamental questions that we would like to know the answer. So the first one is, what is the neutrino masses? What is their hierarchy? But there is also a very important one, maybe even more important than the other ones, that is, what is their nature? Are they Dirac or are they Majorana? And also, is there CP evaluation in the electronic sector? So basically, what I'm going to argue in this talk is that the first two questions, these two, is something that we can address using cosmological observables. And basically, the first one, I will be claiming that if we do things properly, we will achieve like a 5 sigma detection, even for the lower minimum mass. And we can also address this one. This will also depend on what are the neutrino masses. But in principle, I'm also very confident that we can address this one. So now let me go back to cosmology. Let me go back to the very early universe, to the time when the temperature of the universe was about 10 to the 10 Kelvin or 1 MeV. So what happened in this period of the universe? So what happened is that we have neutrinos and antineutrinos that are in thermal equilibrium with photons, electrons, and positrons by reactions like this. So as you know, if you have a particle, if you have a fermion that is in thermal equilibrium, then its momentum distribution will be given by the standard Fermi-Dirac distribution that I'm showing here. So what happens is that when the temperature of the universe drops below 10 to 10 Kelvin, or 1 MeV, basically neutrinos decouple from this primordial plasma, and it can be shown that at any posterior time, once they decouple, their momentum distribution gets frozen. So what this means is that once neutrino decouple, I can write the momentum distribution in this way, where basically this is like the Fermi-Dirac distribution, but here I have to put the momentum and not the energy. And I can explain why. And basically, here we only have one parameter, that is the temperature of the cosmic neutrino background, this here, and it can be shown that this temperature is related with the temperature of the CMB, and today, the temperature of the cosmic neutrino background is more or less like 2 kelvins. So basically, this is really all you need to know in order to understand this cosmic neutrino background. And now let me tell you a little bit about the properties of this cosmic neutrino background. So one of the things that we can do is to integrate the momentum distribution to get the number density. And if we do that, what we will find is that today, there are more or less 100 neutrinos and antineutrinos per cubic centimeter. This is per neutrino mass I state. Another thing that is very important is to compute the mean thermal velocities of these neutrinos. You just, again, from this pseudo Fermi-Dirac distribution, you just integrate it. And let's say for realistic neutrino values, so let's say this is the mass of each eigenstate, so let's say for 50 mil electron volt, the mean thermal velocities today will be something like 3,000 km per second. So this is a very, very large thermal velocity. So for instance, if you compare this with another gravitational velocity scale that you have in the universe, so let's think in galaxy clusters, the typical velocity dispersion there will be around 1,000 km per second. So what we are saying is that basically these neutrinos are moving much faster than this. And this is really the key to understand the effect that neutrinos will introduce on cosmological observables. These neutrinos are moving very, very fast. And this is really the key.
What's the escape velocity for a galaxy?
I think for galaxy clusters it should be of the order of 1,000 km per second. For galaxy clusters, 10 to the 15.
I see, so they're not bound to the...
They are bound. Galaxy cluster, they are bound. You mean the neutrinos or the... Yeah, I will discuss this in detail. I will show you exactly how many of them are bound and how many of them are unbound. It's a very good question. So another thing that we can also compute very easily is what is the fraction of all the energy contained in the universe that is made out of neutrinos. And basically, you can compute this in this way, and basically, you find this. So let's quantify exactly how much is this. So let me show you the pizza of the universe. So we know that dark energy represents more or less like 68% of the energy contained in the universe. Cold dark matter is something like a 27%. We have baryons, you know, iron and helium, stars and metals. These represent more or less like a 5%. So for neutrino masses, if we put here realistic values of the neutrino masses, so the minimum one from neutrino oscillations, but also the upper bound from cosmology, what we get is something like this. So neutrinos represent between the 0.15% and the 0.3%. And this is something that still is really amazed me, because this number is very similar to this one. So even though stars are the first thing that we look whenever we look at the sky at night, neutrinos that are basically the same energy content in the universe, the same fraction of the energy content, is something that even today we have not detected them. And we know that they have to be there. They should be there. So in this talk, whenever I talk about all these different components, I will just talk to them about, I will call them just baryons. So it's very important that in this talk, whenever I talk about cold dark matter, what I really mean is baryons plus cold dark matter. So why do I do this? So the reason for this is basically because saying cold dark matter plus baryon is a bit longer, and this is also becoming a kind of standard, I think, maybe in the field. So cold dark matter for me is really cold dark matter plus baryon. And matter for me will be just baryons, cold dark matter, and neutrinos, so everything. And this is going to be important later. So recapping, so neutrinos are fundamental particles, and we know that they have masses. So the fundamental question that we would like to address are these two. So what are their masses, and what is their hierarchy? So the Big Bang Theory predicts the existence of a cosmic neutrino background. Neutrinos represent a very small fraction of the energy content of the universe. They only represent like a 0.3% at most. But they are moving very, very fast, very fast. And this is the reason why they will introduce particular unique signatures on cosmological observables. So let me tell you about this signature. So let's start simple. Let's start at linear order. So at linear order, there are only two effects that neutrinos introduce. This is something that is very well known and very well understood. The first one is that they modify the matter radiation equality time. And the second one is that they slow down the growth of cold dark matter perturbations on small scales. So this is the effect at linear order. So if we consider if we are only talking about the linear order, then we know that all information is in the Pago spectrum. And basically the only thing that we need to worry in order to understand this effect is to take a look at the Pago spectrum. All information is there. We don't need to look at any other observable. Everything will be there. So if I combine these two effects and I look at the Pago spectrum, this is what the effect that neutrinos introduce. So this is Pago spectrum as a function of weight number. So the red line is for a cosmology with massless neutrinos. And as you increase the sum of the neutrino masses, you basically go in this direction. So what are neutrinos producing here? So you can see that neutrinos, what are producing is a suppression on the power on small scales. And the reason for this is very simple, is that we have a fraction of the dark matter that is made up by massive neutrinos. These massive neutrinos, as you have seen before, they have these very, very large thermal velocities. So they are moving very fast. And basically what will happen is that they will not cluster at linear order. And because they will not cluster, they will also slow down the growth of cold dark matter perturbation on small scales. And this is the reason why we have a suppression in the abundance of power here. On the other hand, if we go to very, very large scales, scales larger than the free streaming length of neutrinos, basically neutrinos will cluster in the same way as cold dark matter. And this is the reason why all the different models have the same amplitude here, but here is different. So this is really the effect of neutrinos. This characteristic scale-dependent suppression on the power, that this is really something unique of neutrinos. So if the effect of neutrinos is so easy, so simple at linear order, why do we have to complicate ourselves in going beyond this? Why this is not the end of the talk? So the reason for this is basically because whenever we look at cosmology, whenever we do large scale structure at low redshift, basically linear theory will only be able to describe accurately the larger scales. Non-linear gravitational evolution will induce some non-linearities, and basically linear theory will not be able to capture there. So this is really the reason why we need to go beyond this. So in other words, if we look at the universe at high redshift and the density fluctuation follow a Gaussian density field, all the information is in the Pago spectrum. I compute the Pago spectrum and that's it, I'm done. But if we are looking at low redshift, basically what we know is that there is a leakage of information that is going from the Pago spectrum into the bispectrum, trispectrum, but also things like the Hilbert function, Boyd mass function, probability distribution function. So in principle, if at low redshift you want to extract all the information that is there, you really need to take a look at all these different things or do reconstruction. So that's basically the idea. So we need to study the effect of neutrinos into the fully nonlinear regime, and I will show you later exactly why is that, why with linear theory it will not be enough. So how do we study the effect of neutrinos into the fully nonlinear regime? So there are many different ways. So we can use semi-analytic methods, perturbation theory. What I will argue is that probably the most sophisticated method, the best way to study the effect of neutrinos or any other thing, is to use numerical simulations. This is because with this numerical simulation, you can study the linear, but also the mildly nonlinear or the fully nonlinear regime. And also you can account for things like baryonic effects that you should put there with your aerodynamical simulations. So the only trade-off here is that, of course, this is the most computationally expensive method with respect to the other ones. But basically, in this talk, I will just focus in on this. So where do we stand right now in terms of the constraint of the neutrino masses? So as I told you before, from neutrino oscillations, we know that the minimum mass has to be at least 60 million electron volts. And this is basically the current constraint that we have from cosmology. So this is a number that has been derived using different probes. But this is the number that the Planck 2018 also came out. And this is just coming from CMB plus VAO. So I will say that this is a very, very robust constraint. So let's be conservative. Let's assume that the neutrino masses will be the minimum one. So if this is the case, what is really the amplitude of the effect that neutrinos are introducing? What should we aim for? And this is what I'm showing here. So this is the ratio between the linear matter power spectrum in a cosmology with massive neutrinos for the minimum one over the massless case. And this is a function of weight number. So the solid line is for the matter density field, and the dashed line is for the colder matter density field. And the distinction between these two guys will become clear later. But in any case, you can see that the maximum difference that we can see here is around like a 3%, something like this. So if we have like a 3% deviation, and we want to achieve like a 3, 4, or 5 sigma detection of the neutrino masses, what this means is that our theoretical model, but also the statistical error bus or systematic error bus, has to be lower than 1% in order to detect this. And this is, as you know, this is very hard. It's very hard to do 1% precision cosmology. So many people have done many different forecasts. I'm very biased, so I'm putting here some of mine, but the literature is really full. It's filled with different forecasts. And for instance, there is Andrei Obuljens, who is a very nice student. He's actually coming here to work with Will. And basically, the conclusion from all these different forecasts using different techniques, using instruments like this, is that basically we will achieve like a 3 to 4 sigma detection of the minimum mass of the neutrino masses, not more than that. If someone is telling you that it will achieve like a 10 sigma, I will be very, very skeptical about this.
Was this linear or nonlinear as well?
So people push a little bit, I think, to K of 0.2, something like this, where you have a little bit of nonlinear. But that's a very good point. Let me go to this slide. So this is something that I've been doing. Actually, I did like yesterday, so I think this plot is right, but take with a bit with a grain of salt. So what I'm trying to show you with this plot is how hard it's going to be to detect the neutrino masses and why we can only achieve like a 3 to 4 sigma detection. So what is this telling you? So what I have assumed is that we have a survey, but basically this is half of the sky, and we are going from redshift 0 all the way to a given redshift, a maximum redshift. And basically what I'm also assuming is that we have measured the power spectrum, we have measured the bias spectrum, we have measured the dry spectrum, we have measured the halo mass function, we have measured the void mass function, we have measured everything, and we have been so smart that we have been able to retrieve all the information that is there until a given Kmax. And I'm assuming that this information, in terms of clustering, will be the one that is embedded into the linear matter power spectrum. And this is an assumption that I think it should be okay. So basically, for instance, a point here represents a redshift, a survey that goes from redshift 0 all the way to redshift like 2, more or less. And basically, I'm assuming that I have extracted all the information all the way to K of 0.15. And this number is telling you what is the error bar that you have on the neutrino masses. And basically, this is what you need in order to get a phi sigma detection of the minimum mass of the neutrino masses. And this is just large scale structure. This will be like a perfect large scale structure survey. So for instance, if we go to k of 0.2, that is something reasonable, I will say, it's going to be super hard to extract all the information there, but let's say like this. So in this case, we will need a survey that goes all the way to k of, I don't know, maybe 4 or 3 point something. So a recipe from recipe 0 to recipe like 4, and extract all the information that is there until k of 0.2 to get a phi sigma detection. And that's why you can imagine that this is going to be super, super hard. So of course, here I'm kind of cheating because this is just a large scale structure survey. We know that there are...
Is that assuming zero neutrino mass, or is that assuming...
This is for the minimum mass.
Minimum mass.
0.06, exactly.
It assumes no primordial non-Gaussian.
Right. Exactly. I'm assuming that everything is in the power spectrum, so initial conditions are Gaussian. I'm assuming that. But this is my working assumption. And I'll also be very happy to know what you think. If I combine all the information from power spectrum, by spectrum, trispectrum, and all these things, I think I should go back to the information that is in the linear matter power spectrum. That's why doing this plot is trivial. It takes like 3 hours.
Is the limiting error coming from uncertainty?
Cosmic variance. Yeah. So in this case, all my free, I mean, here I have omega baryon, H, and S, sigma 8, and the neutrino masses, the typical 6. And here I'm marginalizing over everything. So of course I'm kind of cheating because we know that CMB by itself constrains very well, for instance, omega baryon. So what happens if you combine this thing with, for instance, Planck 2018, only with the TT? I didn't put Lensing because I think Lensing will be, there will be some cross correlation between this and Lensing. So if you do this, this is what you get. So if you see, of course, you can see that things improve. And here basically you can see that Planck by itself is already constraining the data, the neutrino masses very well. But still, so if we go to k of 0.2, you can see that we will need something like a recipe survey, a survey going all the way to 0.6 to get a phi sigma detection. And that's why it's going to be very, very hard to get a phi sigma detection. And I think the other takeaway from this plot is that we need to go into the fully nonlinear gene. If we, of course, push this a little bit more, and of course, if we can even go much there, this is going to be easier. So as much as we can, we need to extract all this information. OK, so 3 to 4 sigma detection. This is what people has been, what they have forecast. And I think this plot shows you also a little bit why this is very reasonable. So if this is the case, if this is really the best thing that we are going to ever do, then I think that we need very accurate theoretical predictions in order to avoid any bias. Because if you don't have an accurate theoretical predictions, then the constraint that you will get on the neutrino masses will be biased. And let me show you an example of how this could be potentially very bad. So let's say that we are in 2022, 2023 with Euclid, DESI, and all this thing, and this is what we have measured, combining different probes. So the neutrino masses will be 50 electron volt plus minus 12 millielectron volt. So I think this is going to be amazing, right? I mean, this is a detection of the neutrino masses, and we have also excluded the normal the inverter hierarchy. So I think this is like a major result. But what happens if we get something like this, right? So basically, it's like the same error bar, but now we have like a 2 sigma away from this number. So my interpretation from this will be that we have not detected the neutrino masses. And what is much more important, I will say, is that we have excluded the minimum mass at 3 sigma. So you know, if we have done the best that we can and we obtain this, I think this has much more important consequences than this. I don't know how can we explain this. Maybe neutrinos decay, I mean, I don't know. But I think this is much more important than this. But if we come out with this simply because our theoretical model is not good enough, because our theory model is not accurate enough, then I think this is going to be catastrophic for us. So this is something that we really want to avoid just because we don't want any bias. And that's why I think this is very important. And then the second thing is that I think we need new and unique observables, so sensitive to the neutrino masses. We want to push these numbers, and we want to achieve a phi sigma detection. So let me recap a little bit of this. So neutrinos are fundamental particles. We know that they have masses. And there are two very fundamental questions. What are their masses? What is their hierarchy that we would like to address using cosmological observables? So the Big Bang Theory predicts the existence of this cosmic neutrino background. Neutrinos only represent like a 0.3%, so a very small fraction of the energy content of the universe, but they are moving very, very, very fast. So this is the reason why they introduce characteristic signature on cosmological observables. Data in that order are very well understood, but in order to extract the maximum information from these surveys, we need to go into the fully nonlinear gene. People have made forecasts, and basically they have obtained, like using standard probes, we will only achieve like a 3 to 4 sigma detection of the neutrino masses, not more than that. And if this is the case, we will need very accurate theoretical prediction. We want to avoid any bias that is there. And I think we need to look for new and unique observables of the neutrino masses to try to go to at least 5 sigma. And in order to make a very robust claim that we have detected neutrino masses. So as you know, we have a model. And in cosmology, we measure neutrino masses using a model. So we are model dependent. So the thing is that if we look at many different observables and we see the effect of neutrinos in all of them, I think this is going to be very hard, that this is just a coincidence. And this is why I think our claim will be much more robust. So I think we need to clearly go into the fully nonlinear gene. So now let me tell you a little bit about a different thing. So the first thing that I want to tell you is how we study this fully nonlinear gene. And I will tell you how actually we run simulation with massive neutrinos. That is something very easy. Then I will tell you a key effect that is the clustering of neutrinos, and this is actually your question. So how many of them really end up? How many of them escape? And this is very important because basically once we understand this, you will see that the effect of neutrino mass introduction, all these other different things, is something that we can understand just taking into account this. So simulation with massive neutrinos. So there are many different methods in order to simulate the neutrinos. So in all these different methods, basically, we model cold dark matter in the same way. So we model cold dark matter as a collisionless and pressionless fluid that we discretize into a set of particles. So then there is a very simple method that is this one, where basically what you do is to generate a neutrino density field in the same way as you generate the initial conditions for a simulation at high redshift. And basically what you do is to just evolve this density field, the neutrino density field, according to linear theory. So that's really very easy. There is a method more sophisticated than that one, where basically you also take into account the back reaction that cold dark matter will have into neutrinos and also the neutrinos into cold dark matter. There is this method that is basically trivial and is to simulate neutrinos in the same way as we simulate cold dark matter. So it's a collisionless and pressureless fluid. And there are more sophisticated methods like this hybrid method where you combine a little bit these two different things. So the only thing that I want to say is that independently of the method that you use to simulate neutrinos, the most important thing is that you generate the initial conditions properly. And the reason for this is basically because in a universe with massive neutrinos, both the growth factor but also the growth rate are scale dependent. So if you don't take this thing into account, you will not be able to reproduce even linear theory. So I don't have time to talk about this. I'm happy to tell you later more details about this. But basically, we wrote a paper stating how you should do these things in cosmology with massive neutrinos. So if you are interested in this simulation, let me just tell you that the simulation that we have been working on for many, many years are now publicly available. So we have more than 1,000 simulations. These are both embodied and full hydrodynamical simulations with massive and massless neutrinos. This is what we call the Hades simulation. So Hades was the Greek god of the underworld. So I think the legend is that when he put his helmet, he became invisible. And I think this is similar to maybe what neutrinos are doing. So all these simulations are stored in a server in New York, in downtown New York. We have more than 200 teras of data. So I think this is a very, very large set of simulations. We have different models with different neutrino masses. Realistic neutrino masses, but also sometimes very unrealistic. Sometimes in order to see the effect of neutrinos, you need to go to these very, very unrealistic values. Otherwise, it's very, very hard. We have simulation with different resolutions, simulation with cosmic variance, with sample variance, without sample variance. We have very large volumes. We have a dynamical simulation, and we have also paid a lot of attention to generate initial conditions properly. So this is just what I want to say about the simulations. Now let's go to your point, the clustering of neutrinos. So what is exactly this? So as I told you before, once neutrino decouple from this primordial plasma, the momentum distribution will be given by this pseudo Fermi-Dirac distribution. We have to put here the momentum and not the energy. And this is basically what I'm showing here. So this is the distribution of velocities as a function of thermal velocities. This is for neutrinos with 0.6 electron volt, but if you have lighter neutrinos, the argument is the same. So just take a look at this red line. So this is a redshift zero. So you can see that the peak of the distribution takes place more or less like a 500 km per second. So what happens when you compare this mean thermal velocity against another velocity, for instance, the velocity dispersion inside our matter halos? So if we look at very small halos, halos of 10 to the, I think this is 10 to the 12 or 10 to the 13, you can see that the velocity dispersion there will be smaller than this typical value, the mean value. But if we go to galaxy clusters, where the velocity dispersion can be as large as 1,000 km per second, what I will say is that naively, I will expect that all neutrinos that are in this tail, whenever they see the presence of one of these big guys, they will cluster. And this is indeed what happens. So let me show you this with a movie. So this is the distribution of cold dark matter, and this is the distribution of neutrinos. And this is as tiny balls. So what happens is that as tiny balls, the thermal velocities of neutrinos shrink. And at some points, the thermal velocities of neutrinos will be low enough, such as they will start seeing the underlying gravitational potential wells of cold dark matter, of dark matter halos, and they will start clustering. So you can clearly see, for instance, how neutrinos are tracing this structure here. This is a void, and you can see how neutrinos are tracing this. So this was in 2D. Let me show you the same thing in 3D. So this is cold dark matter. This is neutrinos. This is total matter. And this is cold dark matter and neutrinos. So if you look at the cold dark matter distribution, you can see all the elements of the cosmic web. So you can see halos, subhalos, filaments, voids, everything, all the elements of the cosmic web. If you look at the neutrino density field, something very interesting happens. So for instance, take a look at this guy. This is a very massive halo. So if you look at this in the neutrino density field, what you can see is now an accumulation of neutrinos there. So you can see that neutrinos are really clustering in the gravitational potential well of these very massive halos. And you can clearly see from this is the neutrino density field, how neutrinos experience a fooling or linear G. Neutrinos are really clustering, and neutrinos, yeah. And in order to study this, I will say that we need numerical simulations. So this is pretty much it. So this is how the distribution of cold dark matter look like, and this is how the distribution of neutrinos look like. This is for 0.6 electron volt neutrinos, and this is for 0.3. So of course, if you have more massive neutrinos, the thermal velocities will be lower, and therefore they will cluster more. And you can clearly see here that they are clustering much more than 0.3 electron volt. If you look at the cold dark matter density field, you can see that basically things look very much the same. They are very, very similar, but they are not exactly the same. So for instance, if you compare this guy versus this guy there, what you can see is this. So what you can see is that here in this cosmology, we have two dark matter halos that are in process of colliding. Whereas in a universe where we have lighter neutrinos, because we know that even at linear order, the growth of cold dark matter perturbation will take place at a lower rate, at a faster rate. Basically what happens is that these two dark matter halos, they have already collided. So the only takeaway from this is that just the presence of massive neutrinos in the universe will induce some back reaction at the level of cold dark matter. Neutrinos by itself will induce these back reactions. So in order to conclude this part, so what I'm showing here, this is just to finalize, this is one dark matter halo in our simulation. This is a halo with a mass of 4 times 10 to the 14. And if you look at the neutrino density field, you can clearly see how neutrinos are clustering, neutrinos are producing these neutrino halos. So one thing that we took a look was, what about the density profiles of cold dark matter in cosmology with massive and massless neutrinos inside halos? And what we find is that in both cases, the density profile of colder matter was very well reproduced by the standard Navarro Fehrenbach profile. But we also find that the density profiles of neutrinos, they also follow like a universal profile that is given by this expression. And then we quantify precisely your question. So what is the fraction of neutrinos that end up in these neutrino halos? Or in other words, what is the fraction of neutrinos that that just leave these halos? And the conclusion is that for even for neutrinos with 0.3 electron volts, so something much more massive than they are supposed to be, only 1 over 1,000 end up in halos. So the conclusion from this is that you can clearly see how neutrinos cluster, but only a very, very, very small fraction of them end up in cluster. Most of them simply are moving so fast that they are just leaving. And this is very important.
And in the fit there, is there a power of alpha that you fit to? Is it a
useful? Yeah. So for me, if I remember, this was, I should know this better. So RC, Rossi, RC, and alpha are three parameters. And I think alpha was close to 2, but I don't remember exactly. But it was a free parameter, yeah. Yeah, we leave it as a free parameter. We don't put like these two. So the conclusion from this part is that inside dark matter halos, both the density profile of cold dark matter and the density profile of neutrinos are going to be universal. And only a very, very small fraction of neutrinos will actually cluster, only a very small fraction of them. And this will have important consequences. So I told you a little bit about simulations, and basically what I have just told you is that neutrinos don't cluster. Even into the fully nonlinear gene, they cluster, but only a very negligible fraction of them. So now let me tell you a little bit about the effect that neutrinos introduce on the different cosmological observables. So coming back to this, one thing that we took a look was whether neutrinos change the concentration of dark matter halos. And the answer is yes. Neutrinos change the concentration. And the reason for this is very easy to understand. So the reason for this is basically because we know that the growth rate, that the growth of perturbation on small scales will take place at a lower rate in cosmology with massive neutrinos. So basically, halos in a cosmology with massive neutrinos for the same max will form later. And we know that there is a correlation between halo formation and concentration. And this is basically the reason why neutrinos change the concentration of dark matter halos, simply because they are forming later. This is the virial radius. This is the virial radius, and these are SSDs. This is an effect that is going to be completely degenerate. One of the other things that can produce this effect, like for instance with sigma-8. So this is basically just that back reaction of neutrinos into cold dark matter.
Growth structure. Where does ionization set in?
What is ionization? You mean reionization?
It's cold dark. It's a cold dark matter. You get a prediction of when stars start being formed. Ionization.
How
do you get from recombination up to the beginning of stars?
Right.
You need cold dark matter.
Yeah, exactly.
Slowing down that growth.
Yeah.
So that affects sigma-8.
Exactly.
So what happens to
sigma-8? So what's
that? What is the value of sigma-8 fluctuations?
Today is like 0.83, something like this. But we don't know this number extremely precisely. If we will know this number with an infinite precision, then we will constrain neutrino masses very well. But basically, there are some limitations coming from CMB, basically because we don't know tau, their reionization depth.
So you fix the angular power spectrum, acoustical power spectrum.
Yes.
Which is incredibly well fitted.
Yes, but still there is...
Sigma-8 is determined pretty accurately.
Yes, it's determined...
You have to fit that,
but still we don't know sigma-8 as precise as we should do. In order to get like a 1% effect, that is to get the neutrino masses, we need a 1%. Oh. And we don't know sigma at that level. And unless we know tau very well, we will not be able to do that. But that's a very good point. If we will know sigma perfectly, I think we are done. And that's the problem. So another effect is another observable is the Hale-Mar function. So I guess everybody is familiar with this, so I'm going to be very quickly. So these are two different cosmologies, this one and this one. So for instance, if you look at redshift 0, basically you can see that the abundance of halos, the Hale-Mar function, is very similar in these two different cosmologies. But as you go back in redshift, you can see that the abundance of halos is very different in the two cases. So the Hale-Mar function is very sensitive to the value of the cosmological parameters, and it's going to be very sensitive to the neutrino masses. So what is the effect that neutrino mass introduce on the Hale-Mar function? So this is what I'm showing here. This is Hale-Mar function as a function of halo mass. So the black line is for a cosmology with massless neutrinos, and the blue is for 0.15 electron volt neutrinos, so something realistic. So you can see what is the effect of neutrinos. So neutrinos produce a suppression on the abundance of the most massive halos. And the reason for this is the same as before. So we know that in a universe with massive neutrinos, the growth of cold matter perturbation will take place at a lower rate, so it's much harder to make halos of the same mass, and in particular, it's much harder to make galaxy clusters in a cosmology with massive neutrinos than in a cosmology with massless neutrinos.
Is this holding total omega matter constant?
Very good, very good. This is holding total omega matter whole, and also keeping the value of AES fixed. Of course, if you change this thing, this will be changed. But this is kind of, I will say, maybe the canonical picture that we usually, when we compare neutrino effects, this is like, but that's a very good point. So I think qualitatively we understand the effect of neutrino masses very well, but we would also like to have something much more quantitative, right? People doing cluster counts using other things, we would like to give them like a prediction. This is the number of the cluster counts that you should expect. So the thing is that it's very common in this field to write the Hale-Mar function to parameterize in this way, where this nu is this thing that is the pit high. And basically the reason for doing this is that at least for some definition of halos, this function here will become universal. And this is very nice because this is telling you that once you know this function, let's say that you fit an n-body simulation or you have some analytical model for this, if you fit this for a given cosmology, you will be able to predict the Hale-Mar function for any other cosmology. You just have to use these variables. So the question that we ask ourselves is, what about cosmology with massive neutrinos? Can we use this kind of fitting functions also to predict the abundance of halos in cosmology with massive neutrinos? So the first thing that you will probably do is to use like the very naive prescription. So basically, is that just use this formula as it is. And the conclusion is that if you use this formula as it is, basically, this doesn't work very well. In fact, this basically doesn't work. And the reason for this is basically because you are doing the underlying assumption by using this formula as it is that all matter in the universe is inside dark matter halos. This is probably true for cold dark matter, but we have seen before that this is not the case for neutrinos. Neutrinos are not inside dark matter halos. Neutrinos don't cluster. So in order to take this thing into account, we propose this, what we call this cold dark matter prescription, that basically is telling you that whenever you have a variable that depends on the matter density of the universe, for instance, the mean density of matter or the matter power spectrum, the linear matter power spectrum, you just change this by the cold dark matter power spectrum, because the masses of the dark matter halos are only made out of cold dark matter. Neutrinos don't cluster. And if you do this, what you will find is that basically this formula works very well. It reproduces incredibly well the abundance of halos in our simulation. And this is like a very simple way to extend the universality of this Hale-Mar function to cosmology with massive neutrinos. Just doing this thing, so it's very simple. Another powerful tool is to do galaxy clustering. So if you have some region of the sky and you observe galaxies, so one thing that you can do is to compute the power spectrum of galaxies. And we know that in linear order, the power spectrum of galaxies will be related with the power spectrum of matter through a bias term. And this is a number, this is a scalar. So the idea is that we can measure this. We don't know the bias, but we can marginalize over this. So we can really measure the shape of the matter power spectrum. And we know that neutrino masses affect the shape, but also other cosmological parameters affect the shape. And this is why we can do cosmology with galaxy clustering. So what we did in this paper was to take a look at this bias in cosmology with massive neutrinos. So this is what I'm showing here. This is halo bias as a function of weight number. So the red line is for a cosmology with massless neutrinos. And as you can see, on large scales, this bias becomes flat, scale independent, as we expect. But this is in agreement with the theory. But what happens if we take a look at this line? So this is 4.6 electron volt neutrinos. So you can see that here, even on very, very large scales, the bias is now scale dependent. And this was very surprising, right? Because, I mean, how is this possible? So we thought that we have done something wrong with the simulation. This thing happened, right? But no, everything was fine. And this was true. We repeat the same thing using different simulations. So what is our interpretation here? So our interpretation here is that in the same way as the colder matter density field is the one that is really responsible to describe the abundance of dark matter halos, probably this is also the field that is responsible to describe the clustering properties of dark matter halos. So what I'm showing here, this is bias as a function of weight number. Just take a look at these two lines. So if we define the bias in the standard way, we obtain this dashed line. And you can see that the bias is scale dependent, even on very large scales. But what happens if I define the bias with respect to the colder matter? So if I define the bias with respect to the colder matter, we obtain this scale independent. And basically now the bias becomes to be flat. So the conclusion from this was that indeed, the abundance of halos, but also the clustering of halos, are really described by the colder matter density field. Basically because neutrinos don't cluster. So for cosmological analysis, remember that this is not correct. In a cosmology with massive neutrinos, you cannot write this. In a cosmology with massive neutrinos, you should write the power spectrum of galaxies as a bias times the power spectrum of colder matter. So what we did is that also if you define the bias in this way with respect to colder matter, then basically the bias will become universal across masses, across redshift, across neutrino masses. And that's, I think, is very nice.
Can I ask a
question? Yes.
Going back to your definition of cold dark matter, yeah. This includes the baryons, or this does not?
Yes, include everything includes baryons.
Okay, so it's everything but neutrinos.
It's everything but neutrinos, exactly. Very good point. Thank you for it. I don't know how should I call this, right? I mean, cold dark matter plus baryon matter is super low, I don't know. So another thing that we also did is that basically if you are using the incorrect model like this, basically what will happen is that you will introduce a bias on the value that you will obtain on the cosmological parameters. And remember that we don't want any bias. In principle, we will only achieve like a 3 to 4 sigma detection. If we put like 1 or 1.5 sigma bias, this can ruin our conclusions. So that's why it's very important to really use the correct theoretical model. And the last thing that I want to say is that I think this is also something like kind of unique. I think this is a kind of unique observable. So with galaxy clustering, what we are really proving, take a look here, is really the power spectrum of colder matter. With weak lensing, what we can really measure is the power spectrum of total matter. We are sensitive to this thing. So if we compare these two guys, and they are not the same, because in a cosmology with massless neutrinos, they are the same. But in a cosmology with massive neutrinos, they are different. So for instance, if we compute things like the ratio of these two guys, and we get like a scale-dependent bias, this is a unique signature of neutrinos. I don't know any other effect that can produce this. Any other cosmological observable will not produce this. I don't know if maybe some strange modified gravity theories will do, but and I think this is why it's one of these unique observables where the effect of neutrinos can be used as a kind of a smoking gun, I think. So this was in real space. So far I told you that the overdensities of halos just trace the overdensities of colder matter, but what we really observe are the position of galaxies in redshift space. So the question that we ask ourselves is, what about the peculiar velocities of halos or the peculiar velocities of galaxies? Are also tracing the underlying colder matter density field, or are they tracing the total matter density field? So we did this in this paper, and basically the conclusion was that also the peculiar velocities of halos or of galaxies are really tracing the underlying colder matter density field, not the total matter density field. And of course, this is very important for those of you that are doing KHC cosmology. And for galaxy clustering, this means that this is like the correct theory model at linear order. So you will have some bias. This is the growth rate of colder matter, mu squared. This is the power spectrum of colder matter. And this is your shot noise.
That seems counterintuitive to me because velocities are sensitive to very large scales. And there, on those scales, the neutrinos do have structure. They're not smooth. So is there a way to understand this?
That's a very, very good question. So we also thought that the peculiar velocities of halos should trace the matter field because of this reason like this. So We have some arguments from perturbation theory. You know, you can write like the equation that I forgot how it's called. It's the equation that relates the perturbation of the perturbation of cold dark matter with, of the perturbation of the density with the perturbation on the velocities. And basically, there were some perturbation theory arguments. We can discuss this later if you want. Where basically you can show that even for halos, you should expect really to trace the cold dark matter. Because your densities are really tracing the densities of your galaxies, of your halos are tracing the cold dark matter density field, and these two equations are related. But this, I agree with you. We can maybe discuss this later. But that's a very good question. So I'm running super late of time, so I will skip the things about the power spectrum. I will also skip the baryonic effects, the degeneracies, and let me just talk about something that I think is very nice. That is about voids. So this is like a cartoon showing the large scale structure around us. So we are here in the center. So far I talk about the effect of neutrinos on galaxies, halos, clusters. So basically about the luminous regions here. But what about the effect of neutrinos on voids? What about the effect of neutrinos on these regions where basically there is nothing? So first of all, let me talk about the dynamics of voids. So the dynamics of voids is very simple. So let's say that you have a taut hub under dense perturbation like this, at very high redshift. So the evolution of this perturbation is basically very simple. This perturbation will become bigger and bigger and enter with time. So in order to see this, just take a look, for instance, at this region here. So this is a movie, yeah, for you to see. So you can see that this is a void, and this is expanding, but it's also becoming emptier and emptier and emptier. So take a look again. And you can see, this is the dynamics of voids. So as long as there is no shell crossing, also the mass inside these voids will be the same, will be conserved. So this is basically the case for a universe where you have massless neutrinos. But what about in a universe where you have massive neutrinos? So let's say that you start with a taut hub under dense perturbation for the cold dark matter density field, the same as before. So this perturbation will have the same dynamics. So it's going to become bigger and bigger and bigger and emptier and emptier and emptier in the same way. But what is the difference here, where we have a universe with massive neutrinos? So the difference here is that we will have the cosmic neutrino background will be on top of the void. And basically, we have seen before that these neutrinos don't cluster inside halos. They are moving so fast that basically you will not expect that these neutrinos will evacuate the void. Neutrinos will be just sitting on top of the void and they will be there. So the difference here is that as the void is becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, the mass just coming from neutrinos, simply because neutrinos will be everywhere, will become larger and larger and larger. And this extra mass, this is an extra mass that is only coming in cosmology with massive neutrinos. I don't have this mass here. So what this extra mass should produce is that voids in a cosmology with massive neutrinos should be smaller and should be denser. And if you just plot like a, if you just run an envoy simulation and you plot the density field, you can just see this by eye. So for instance, this is for a cosmology with massless neutrinos, and this is for 0.6 electron volt. And you can clearly see here how voids in a cosmology with massless neutrinos are emptier. So what we did in this paper was to actually quantify this. We ran simulation, we identify voids. And indeed, we find that in terms of the abundance, in cosmology with massive neutrinos, you have a suppression in the abundance of the most massive voids, but also you have a higher abundance of the smaller voids. So this is exactly what we expected. And another thing that we find is that indeed, in cosmology with massive neutrinos, voids will be denser. Something that is very, very nice is that what we found was that this degeneracy, that this is your question before, why we cannot measure neutrino masses, because there is this degeneracy with sigma 8, and this is something that affects all, basically most of the observables. If we take a look at voids, this degeneracy is broken. And this is, I think, very nice. So I really think that voids are a unique environment to study depth of neutrinos. This is something that usually we don't study in cosmology. We don't use voids. But I think there is a lot of information from neutrino masses going in these guys. Yeah?
There's recently been published papers on low surface brightness galaxies. One of them, for example, is AGC 1052 DF2. I document how the dispersion velocities are best filled without any dark matter.
they are best fit without or?
Without Tonian. So, what about the neutrinos in there? Another issue is this Hedges experiment. Top 21 centimeter height. The depth, the temperature 21 centimeters is a big tip. And that's best fitted without dark matter. So, what would the neutrinos be doing with that? This is, if that continues, that's a big problem.
I agree. But we also know that neutrinos cannot be all dark matter. We also know that neutrinos cannot be all dark matter.
No, obviously not. But then if there's an absence of dark matter somewhere, then neutrinos will become important.
Yeah.
Neutrinos you're talking about, so for, you know, these small galaxies, I think that neutrinos don't do anything. So far below the free streaming scale that they're just floating through it, right? I mean, they can't be bound to those.
Yeah, that's the problem. We know neutrinos exist, but we're still looking for dark matter.
Yeah, I agree. There was a question.
I think this might be a really stupid question.
No.
Ask it anyway.
Only a stupid answers, no.
When you talk about, if you want to do something very accurate with void statistics, I always get confused how you define the void, because the shape seems to matter. It seems less intuitive somehow than galaxies. Is this an issue, or?
It is an issue, but that's not a stupid question. I think this is a very good question. I think maybe you know more than that. So, I agree. I think my understanding of this is that we still don't have a definition of what a void is, and I completely agree with you. If we define voids with a different void finder, all these things change, and this really changed a lot. So that's the reason why I think we still are not doing cosmology with voids. The only thing that I'm saying is that we should probably try to, you know, develop the tools to become something standard and in order to use the information there. But you are completely right with that.
Regarding this comment, why did the voids have any neutrinos?
So the reason for this is that if you have a dark matter halo, a galaxy, basically these neutrinos are moving so fast that they don't cluster. They don't do anything to the halo. But these voids are so huge, they can have a sizes of 100 megaparsec, that neutrinos will be on top of this. So and that's a good point that I want to emphasize. These voids are basically, there is nothing inside there. They are completely empty, almost empty. There is only a very little cold dark matter inside them, and a little bit of baryons. But they are full of neutrinos. So these neutrinos have a very small masses, but voids are probably the only environment where the fraction of cold dark matter and the fraction of neutrinos are kind of similar, are 50%. And that's why we think that the effects there will be much, much larger than the effect of halos.
What void speeds detected, which is almost a gigaparsec?
A void? A gigaparsec, maybe it's too much, I will say. One gigaparsec.
It's almost a gigaparsec in size.
It's
huge.
This is like from Recif 0 to Recif 1, almost, no? So let me just put the summary. So neutrinos are fundamental particles. We know that they have masses. These are the two fundamental questions that we would like to address using cosmological observables. What are their masses and what is their hierarchy? So the Big Bang theory predicts the existence of the cosmic neutrino background. Neutrinos only represent like a very small fraction of the energy content of the universe, 0.3% at most, but they are moving very, very, very fast. So this is the reason why they introduce characteristic signature on cosmological observables. And we know very well at linear order what these are. But in order to extract the maximum information from cosmological surveys, we need to go into the fully nonlinear gene. So many people have done forecasts, and I have also tried to show you why this is the case, that we will only achieve, in principle, like a 3 to 4 sigma detection of the neutrino masses. And if this is the case, we need very, very accurate theoretical prediction. We want to avoid any bias possible. But we also think that we need to look for new and unique observables, something like these voids. in order to try to increase this number to at least phi sigma. And I have told you about the effect of neutrinos effects on introduction, many different cosmological effects, and how I think with the coming data from the SE, LSST, Euclid, and all the different instruments, I think we, if we do things properly, we will achieve a phi sigma detection. So thank you. Thank you very much.
So I work in the DESI project,
uh-huh.
And one of its properties is, you know, it has all these fiber positioners. So every part on the sky, we have to put a fiber somewhere. Is there something smart we can do to help the detection of voids?
I don't really know. I don't know if someone, I don't know, maybe okay. Will kind of... I don't know. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Why do you write modified gravity?
Yeah, so this is something that I didn't explain. So the only thing that I wanted to explain here, maybe if you, is only this slide. So basically in this world, what we show is that basically if you have a universe where you have modified gravity and you have massive neutrinos, this particular model is very degenerate with lambda cold dark matter. So the only thing that this is telling you is that the effect of modified gravity can be undone by neutrinos. So if you start opening the parameter space, if instead of having the standard 6 parameter for lambda cold dark matter and neutrinos, you put modified gravity and you also put another parameters, because there will be these degeneracies, basically the constraint on the neutrino masses will degrade. And instead, and in that case, even beyond getting like this 3 to 4 sigma detection, you might even get worse. You might only get like a 2 or, I don't know, 1 sigma detection. And basically, this was my only thing to say, that we need to look for these unique observables, maybe something like voids, where nothing else can mimic these effects.
There's new papers come out showing that there's a, seems to me, the definite result from hundreds of galaxies. It's a acceleration in the galaxies. It's traced by dark baryons only.
Is traced by dark baryons.
By
baryons.
By luminous. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of discussion about this. So, this raises the issue of how much modified gravity versus.
I don't think that provides any kind of serious evidence for modified gravity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that. I forget the name of the person who wrote the paper, it was someone from Case Western.
Casey, I called
but it. But I don't think it provides any. Real important evidence for modified gravity.
Why do you say that?
Because people involved in simulations found the same correlations with, and there were, you know, I'm not, my astrophysics is not very good. There were some qualitative explanations as well, which I didn't really understand, but you know, the people seemed reasonable, so I.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's no dispute the observation, but I
yeah.
think just the interpretation is providing evidence for. Something beyond cold dark matter. It's very sensitive.
Well, it raises a question, which is what physics is all about.
No. I mean, people try to answer that question to try to understand it within that scenario. I'm just telling you, I don't remember the explanations, and I'm not enough of an astrophysicist to appreciate them properly.
I mean, at any rate, again, I think the scales we're talking about are vastly different.
Right.
I know the answer on this thing, but I think the recent measurement by this gravitational wave detection. I think it has ruled out a lot of these models already. Probably not all of them, but many of them has been ruled out.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay. Maybe I have just one quick question.
Yes, please.
So when you showed us the improvement with lensing, does that include this effect that you mentioned later on that when I'm comparing...
Which...
So one of the first plots you showed where it was telling us how we get to five sigma.
Ah, right. This one.
Yeah, this one.
So this is only large scale structure.
Yeah.
And this is large scale structure plus TT from Planck.
Oh,
I don't put
TT.
Lensing.
Sorry. Oh.
Because I think lensing will be the general. I mean, there will be some covariance between the lensing from CMB and like a perfect world like this. That's why I didn't include. So I think let's be conservative. TT from Planck and large scale structure.
I just to, I don't, you know, there was this paper, I don't know if you saw this paper last week by Liz Gourgeat.
Yes, yes, I know.
They claim that future CMB service at basically S4, I think because of the
because of
information from Lansing, will give much better.
I haven't read it either, but I think it's mostly because of tau, because they will constrain tau much more. So I think from this paper, if you look at CMB S4, I think these numbers are still, maybe they get like a 4 sigma, something like this. But if you look at...
And there are ones where they, there are plots toward the end of the paper where they include like CMB S4 and Lightbird, and they get error bars that are quite a bit below 10 to the minus 2 EV. So it's more like 10, more than 5 sigma.
With CMB S4, but people has make a lot of forecasts. And I think CMB S4 has, I think it's in the there was this white book, I think, recently. And I think they will not get that 5 sigma.
Okay, I was wondering. I mean, I've heard also, most talks I've heard give more pessimistic error bars than
yeah.
that. Anyway, I'm just curious what.
But I think in that paper, there are these instruments like Pixie and these things where they will measure tau much more. And in that case, they achieve more than a 5 sigma. But again, this is coming from tau itself.
Other questions? If not, let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.